And this will be an introduction to random matrix theory. And I will say a few words about different situations where random matrix models turn out to give a very good description of things which happen. And later on, I will give a mathematical explanation or introduce a mathematical concepts which are relevant for the case of the unitary ensembles. So I will not speak too much about the history of random matrix theory. I would like just to mention one experiment, which is the first experiment that was modeled by the random matrix theory, is the following experiment. So people in the 50s were looking at a scattering problem. So suppose that we have an atom or maybe a piece of metal here, and then there are neutrons coming in, and depending on the energy of the incoming particles, we measure how many of them will pass through and how many will be scattered away. So if one plots the so-called cross-section diagram, so this is basically the percentage of the particles which come through depending on the energy of the incoming particle, then vast experimental data was accumulated and it looks completely random, chaotic like that, and there is no way to describe it. So what people, it's of course impossible to solve the corresponding equations because there are so many degrees of freedom that it's hopeless even using modern computers. So what people did instead, they looked at the maxima here and the corresponding energies, and then they considered the difference of these coordinates. So these are nearest neighbor distances. And then one could take a piece of the energy axis where maybe with hundreds or even thousands peaks, and one could normalize by the mean spacing and plot the spacing histogram. And it turns out that it looks something like this. So, and then Eugene Wigner had an idea that since we don't know anything about the behavior of the large Hamiltonian, what we could do instead, we could think that they're just a black box, and we could take a matrix, a Hermitian matrix of a large size with, so let's take a Hermitian matrix, M of a large size, and we can assume that its entries, its algebraically independent entries, are independent, identically distributed random variables. For example, normally distributed. So this will be MII's and MIJ's, real MIJ's imaginary if I is less than J. So we have a set of independent identity distributed random variables, and then what we could do, we could compute the eigenvalues of the realization of such a random matrix. And then we could take a number of realizations, and then we could compute the distances and normalize by the mean distance between the eigenvalues. So we assume that these eigenvalues are in fact ordered. To be ordered like this. So lambda 1 is the smallest one. Okay. Yes?
Why do you need to normalize? I don't understand this.
You don't need to, you normalize this distance, because you were normalizing the distance between the energies. So what I would like to say is the following. You have this experiment. Then suppose you have 1,000 energies.
You're just changing the horizontal scale. Right?
That's right. That's the only thing. So when you do the same thing with these distances, then it turns out that if you plot the nearest spacing normalized distance, then you get the same histogram.
So can you, because this is important, clarify again, what is defining your...
So here I have the normalized nearest neighbor distance.
What's defining your normalization?
So suppose I take 1,000 peaks. I compute those distances. I just compute the mean and divide by the mean. That's all.
Okay.
They're just dividing by the mean area, the experimental mean.
The experimental mean of the energies? Or the
yeah. Okay. And then I do the same with the matrix. I just take a number of it. Okay. And then one thing is that the size doesn't need to be very large. In fact, even if you take it, say, 40 by 40 matrices, then you will see very good agreement with that. So the function which describes this can be approximately written as some constant times x, and then e to some other constant times x squared, if I call this x as x. Now, it is not exactly equal to that function. It's equal to some other function, which is written in terms of a solution to certain finite equation. But this is a very good description. So in particular, you see that small distances don't occur. So this is known as a level repulsion. And that's a very characteristic feature of random matrix theory. So, well, that explains in which way random matrices model quantities that arise in experiments. So I'm not saying anything exact. I'm just saying about statistical properties. I'm speaking about statistical properties here.
How large do you have to get in order to have not the dependence on the particular matrix?
If you do experimental computations, I think that you will even see it. So mathematical statements are, of course, in the limit as the size tends to infinity. But if you take sizes to be, say, 50 by 50, you will see the same phenomenon. If you will be, instead of Gaussian random variables, if you will be taking random variables like this, where m is some integer, then you will see the same results. And even you will see the same results even if you will be taking your entries here to be, for example, just discrete random variables or anything. So really,
just Bernoulli would be good.
Yes. So I will speak about it later. So this is a general. This is a general kind of question here, so maybe I should address it. So here we took a Hermitian matrix, and then the random variables were, say, normally distributed. And the question is, what is the appropriate distribution for the random for those entries, that, so that we get a good model?
But the distribution of eigenvalues in the limit of n goes to infinity does not depend on the.
So this is the kind of the universality conjecture. That's what I'm going to prove. So the question is, what distribution of random matrix elements should we choose? And the answer is that, in fact, up to general symmetry requirements, which I will explain in more detail in 5 minutes. So the answer, as n tends to infinity, as the size of the matrix grows, is independent of the random matrix of the distributions.
you say the answer, you mean the distribution of the eigenvectors?
The distributions on the set of the eigenvectors. One could look at different statistics. One could look at the nearest neighbor distribution. Or one could look at some correlation functions, which are basic, and I will also define those. So basically, any statistic built on the eigenvalue will be independent. Now, this is not a mathematical statement. This is what people believe in. Okay, so this is known as a universality conjecture. And if you look, for example, in the classical book on the subject by Mehta, which is called Random Matrices, so now there is a third edition available, then on some page 8 or something like that, you will find this statement. So this is not a proven statement. However, this is probably the most important problem in this area. But what is known is that if you consider random matrix ensembles, as they're called, with some symmetry requirements on them, then this statement can be proven. But what I formulated up there is just something that should be true if you just assume that the matrix is Hermitian. And it will be clear in a second what I mean by those symmetry requirements. So now it is actually a big surprise that not only this problem, but really many, many other models, many, many other processes are very well modeled by eigenvalues of random matrix. Yes?
Something we said about the eigenvectors?
Eigenvectors are not, people don't usually study eigenvectors here. So basically what we want, we want to integrate them out. So I will not be speaking about eigenvectors at all. Okay. So maybe I just give a little, excuse me?
But we know a lot about the eigenvectors.
Right. But I'm not studying eigenvectors myself. Okay. So I will now just list several problems where random matrices provide a very good model, and I could go on and on, but I really don't want to spend too much time on that. So just a general thing that you should remember is the following. Maybe I just start with that. So suppose you look at this, the following problem. So suppose you have a bus stop, and then you have buses arrive independently, so that the only thing we know is that the expected value of buses per second is equal to 1. So you know the density, and then they arrive independently. Then it is known, and that's something you learn in an introductory probability course, that the spacing between the buses is Poisson. This means that the graph looks like this. And the probability that spacing is less than or equal to some number x is equal to integral from 0 to the x e to the minus little x dx. So here we have independent buses. Now, this is not at all, so this is spacing. And this is the spacing density. Sorry?
It's actually pretty unlikely that in real life two buses arrive very, very close together.
Well,
oh, yes, it is.
but you don't question that this statement is correct, right? Okay.
If they're in, yes.
You are used to a much better bus system than it's not uncommon in Boston on the same route to see no buses for 20 minutes, and then a bus will come completely packed full, and right behind it is an empty bus.
So then maybe some of you know the next example here, and there's a very nice example. There is a city in Mexico, Cuernavaca. And then there is no municipal bus system there. So what they have is they have a number of routes, and then there are no timetables there. However, the drivers, so they all like private little buses, but the drivers don't like the bunch, because then it means they don't have passengers. So what they do, they have their friends helping them. So there are posts somewhere along the routes, and there are observers. And they see that if the bus is full, going to some destination, then they will call their friend who goes to the same destination and tell him to speed up. And if a bus has just left, if there is no bus and people are waiting for the bus, then they would call their friend and tell him to come faster. However, if a bus has just left, then they will ask him to kind of slow down. So they would like to avoid bunching. And then there is a Czech physicist, Sheba, who spent a month there, and he studied the arrivals and departure times of those buses. And there are, I think, about 3,000 times that he collected in 1 month. And then what he did, he plotted this normalized bus arrival spacing. And he averaged over several bus stops. And then it turns out that what he observed was basically a distribution like this. So this is not quite the same as I draw over there. This is something more like a constant, and it's x squared is another constant x squared. So this corresponds to the unitary ensembles, or to the Gaussian unitary ensemble. And what I draw here, it corresponds to the Gaussian orthogonal ensemble, or more generally for a set of orthogonal ensembles, if you know about the mathematical statement of universality. Now, so that's another instance where you see a random matrix pattern very clearly. And now, in fact, there is a work by Borodin, Dave and Suidan, I think, and they explain this phenomenon. They introduce a model, and they actually prove that this should be the case. So, and finally, for physics audience, I would maybe like to mention a hydrogen atom in a magnetic field. So we studied the electron energies, and we studied again the spacing between the energies. So we studied the spacings, and then we have a picture here as the magnetic field grows. So then the experimental data tells us that the distribution will be actually changing between such a distribution as the field grows. And so there is a transition between these two cases. And finally, if the magnetic field is very strong, then you will see this picture. So this is the general kind of situation between the, if you want, an integrable system and a chaotic system. But I will not spend too much time now discussing all that. And let me just say that you could also study, for example, eigenfrequencies of plates. And if you start with maybe a square plate, and then if you start removing a little piece, then when you do that, then if you look at the eigenfrequencies, if you just measure them, then the distances between the eigenfrequencies will also exhibit such a transition. And there is one could mention a Bohiga's Giannone-Smith conjecture here, which says that if we have a kind of a a chaotic system, then the spectrum should behave, the distances, spectral distances should behave like that. But again, this is not proven. That's just a very general conjecture, right? But what the corresponding matrices, you could think here that you start with just with a diagonal matrix. And then here you have a full matrix, a full, say, Hermitian matrix like this. And then people believe that this intermediate region, the transition between the two, can be modeled using bended matrices. So people believe that if you take a matrix of a size, say, n, then the bandwidth should be of the order square root of n, and then you have random elements here. Then if you compute the statistics of the eigenvalues, the neighboring distances, then as this kind of width grows, then the eigenvalues will exhibit this transition. And again, there are some numerical, there is numerical evidence, but this is not proven. Yes?
In the transition towards the...
as the size... Right, and this is kind of where the transition starts. So, okay. So I just wanted to mention these general things. And then there are, of course, problems in pure mathematics, which are also modeled by random matrices. And the most spectacular example is the distribution of the distances, normalized distances between the zeros of zeta functions. So maybe that will be the last example before I start some rigorous explanations. So let me see here. I just don't want to make a mistake in this thing here. So think about the Riemann zeta function. Then, assuming the Riemann hypothesis, all the zeros lie on the line, and they will be formed 1 half plus I times gamma, say j. And then what one could do, one could introduce a new gammas, which by this condition, and then this condition guarantees that the number of this kind of renormalized heights divided by t will tend to 1 as t tends to infinity. So then, this was proven by Montgomery in the 70s. The following quantity, so 1 over capital N times the number of pairs of indices, J1 and J2, so that they are both between 1 and n, and so that the distance, so this coordinates, this distance belongs to some interval a to b. So if we define such a quantity, then what Montgomery showed is that as n tends to infinity, then this will be converging to the integral from a to b of a function which looks like this, 1 minus sine phi t, t squared dt. And this function is nothing but the so-called the two-point correlation function for the unitary ensembles, or if you want, for the Gaussian unitary ensemble. But again, by universality, really, be the same function for the wide class of unitary ensembles. And so that's a remarkable fact. And also, one could look at combinatorial problems involving permutations and increasing subsequences in permutations. And also, one could look at a 2x2 lattice models where a particle wants to move from the origin to some point with coordinates m and n, and then along a lattice, and then it waits at each side some random time. And then what we would like to compute, we'd like to compute the maximal time if this particle moves only up and to the right, so what the maximal time that could happen would behave like. So this can also be modeled using random bits. So this is like a random point process. So there are many other examples, but let me now formulate some mathematical statements. So mathematically, there are three types of invariant ensembles. So we'll be speaking about invariant ensembles now. And in all three of them, the probability of a matrix, the probability is defined in the set of matrices by the following formula. So there is a parameter beta here, which I will describe later, and then n is maybe the size of the matrix. So the probability looks like this. Some normalizing constant times e to minus some function of a matrix, and then times dm. So where dm is just a product measure on the algebraically independent entries or parameters that describe the matrix, and then we assume the following. So there are three cases. One case is so-called unitary case, where this parameter will have value 2. And we assume that the matrix is Hermitian of size n by n. And we assume that this density p beta n is invariant under conjugations like this. If I replace the matrix by UMU star, then the value of the density at that new matrix should be the same as the original value for any unitary matrix U. Okay. So in the second case,
how does the beta enter here?
I will explain. There is no, in that formula, you don't see that connection. You will see it in the next formula, which I will. So the next case is, so now you see that this name, unitary ensemble, it really refers to the type of symmetry that we assume our distribution density to be invariant under. It doesn't. It's not the matrices that are unitary. The matrices are Hermitian. Okay, so it's the symmetry which gives the name. So now, in the second case, the matrices are real and symmetric. of the same size. And so P, this P1, if you want. Here we have P2, here we have P1. So P1 is an invariant under the changes like this, where we take orthogonal matrices. And finally, in the third case, which is called the symplectic case, this data has value 4, and the matrices are Hermitian. And we also assume that they satisfy the following conditions. So the matrix M is the same as JMT times J inverse, where so one thing is that now the matrices have a double size like that, 2n by 2n. And J is a special matrix which looks like this. So it has capital N cells and then zeros everywhere else.
So it's actually the identity tensor signal bar.
Yeah. So this condition is called that M is called self-dual. And also, we assume that P4 is invariant under, so now 2N, is invariant under the conjugations for S, which is for the first unitary. And secondly, it's such that S, J, S, star is equal to the discourse for any S such that. So the second condition, because of the second condition, S is called symplectic. So this is a unitary and symplectic matrix, which gives us the conjugation. So now these conditions might look strange, but they have two good things about them. One is that because of these conditions, we will be able to reduce the distribution density initially defined on a set of, say, something like n squared parameters just to the eigenvalues. That's one very useful thing. Now, the other thing is that actually they correspond to different types of physical systems in a way. If you think that your physical Hamiltonian is given by a finite size matrix, then depending on if you have or don't have the spherical symmetry or time reversal symmetry, then one of these three ensembles is appropriate. And this was understood by Dyson in the 60s. So this value beta, this type of symmetry, it actually has a physical relevance. Now, because we assume this invariance, what we could do, and in all the three cases, the matrix is either symmetric or Hermitian, so we can bring it to the diagonal form. So if we do this, so if we write M as, say, T, and then say lambda, or maybe D, T minus 1, where D is the matrix, the diagonal matrix which has eigenvalues on the diagonal, then you will see that by this invariance condition, this function capital F of M, which we have in the normalizing factor, is in fact a symmetric function of the eigenvalues. So it doesn't depend on the eigenvectors because we assume this invariance. And now an important class of such matrices F, such functions F, so an important class which we will speak about here is that F of M is equal to trace of some function of the matrix.
Symmetric function, you mean under permutations?
Under permutations of the eigenvalues, because you could always permute the eigenvalues. So, symmetric function, yes, of the eigen, underproved, right. So where V for us will be, maybe I write V of T, so we will be speaking about weights which are polynomials and which have a leading coefficient, let me call it kappa to M. So kappa to M is a real, so that's a real polynomial with a positive leading coefficient. So this will be the class of V's that we will consider here. So, now, it turns out that we can, so what we will study, we will always study the expectations of some functions that depend on the eigenvalues only. So this is the main object that we study here. And it turns out that P beta n can be written as a product of some density on the eigenvalues and some density on the eigenvectors, if you want, on the matrix T that diagonalizes M. And that's a very useful fact because the other thing will always integrate out when we compute such expectations. So in other words, they're statistically independent. The eigenvectors and the eigenvalues are statistically independent. And this is because we have this invariance. So without this invariance, we're really in trouble because we can't really compute eigenvalues and everything seems to depend on everything. And that's why this universality conjecture that I stated earlier is not proven. So now when we so we can write down the distribution density on the set of the eigenvalues, eigenvectors now. And I denote it by the same letter. It's a P.
This is out for all three cases.
Yes, this is the case for all the three cases, and I will write it down here. So the distribution density on the set, I use the same letter. Okay, I hope there is no confusion because of that. So, and I use the same letter for the normalizing constant, and then it turns out that it has the following form. So we'll have a product of the differences raised to the power beta, where beta is, as I described, 1 to 4, times the product of e to the minus v of x I. And we can write dx1. Dxn, we can write dx1, dxn here. So this is the distribution density on the set of the eigenvalues. Okay. Now you see that this fact, this product, it shows you this level of repulsion. So it's important that you see that it's unlikely that x, any two of the eigenvalues are the same, because we have these different distances there, which so the density is smaller. So you see this level of repulsion that we saw in the experiments. You see that built in that formula. So now I will show. So now I would like to explain. So probably you've heard that orthogonal polynomials are a useful tool in this theory. So I will explain why they're a useful tool. So let us. So let us introduce the so-called correlation function. So the Elf correlation function. Well, let me from now on consider just the case theta equals 2. Because it's technically the easiest one, and I just would like to speak about unitary ensembles. So now, Gaussian unitary ensemble is the ensemble where our V is just T squared. So it turns out that all the statistical objects that we want to look at can be written in terms of the so-called L-point correlation functions, which can be defined in this way. So we take, so now let me just write P2 all the time. So I have this P2 on the all points, and what I do, I integrate out all of them, starting from the L plus first. So this is an L called an L-point correlation function. Now, why orthogonal polynomials are useful polynomials are useful in this theory due to the following fact. So let us, because of the following fact. So this is a theorem due to Godin. That's around 62, something like that. And Godin maybe together with Mehta. So the theorem says that for any L, this correlation function can be written, and that's an identical formula. It's not an asymptotic or approximate, that's an identical, that's kind of an identity. Is equal to a determinant of the following matrix. So we have a function capital K, which I will define in a second, and we substitute these points in it, and we build a matrix like this. We compute the determinant. And this correlation function is equal to the determinant where Kn is given by the following formula. It's a sum from 0 to n minus 1. And then we have certain functions, which I define in the next line. So where phi I of x is a function which looks like this. There is a constant, a normalizing constant, Cj, 1 over Cj. And then there is a polynomial here, Xj plus and lower order terms with leading coefficient 1. And then there is an E, the minus 1 half of the V of X. And V is as it was in our up there. So for the real values, and this polynomial is called the pi j of x. And these functions are so that the integral from minus infinity to infinity, phi I j, phi k, phi j, phi k of x is equal to the either 1 or 0, the Kronecker delta symbol.
The UVC is on the right-hand side of the first equation, or what?
This number that
on the above.
I equal J, I suppose.
Yeah. This is I, and this is I.
In the line below, I is equal to J, I suppose.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. J. Thanks. Okay. All right. So you can say that these are orthonormal functions, and these things are called orthogonal polynomials. This polynomial PJ. So it's possible this system of orthogonal polynomials exists as a general fact because this weight has an infinite number of points of growth, that's a continuous function and all that. So for the Gaussian weight, we'll have Hermite polynomials. And for general weights, we'll have general orthogonal polynomials. So that's a very remarkable formula that the correlation function can be written in terms of such a kernel. And that's, if you think about it, this is the projection, the kernel of the integral graph projection, the span of the first n orthogonal function, which is a very natural thing to do, to look at. So this is called the Christoffel-Darboux kernel. And so that's a remarkable theorem. And also, in fact, the original density P and also the original density is P 2 of n of them can be written as 1 over n factorial, then a determinant like this. So ij go from 1 to n. So such a formula also holds. So really, we see that the correlation functions can be written in terms of orthogonal polynomials. And therefore, the only thing we have to study, if we want to study the behavior of, say, correlation functions as the size capital N tends to infinity, the only thing we have to study is really orthogonal polynomials. However, it's not so clear at the first sight because in the sum in Kn, it grows with capital N. So it's not clear how to study such a growing sum. But in fact, there is a classical Christoffel-Darboux formula, which says that, so this is a Christoffel-Darboux formula, which says that this Kn of x, in fact, of x and y, in fact, can be written as a Bn, I will tell you what Bn is in a second, times phi n of x, phi n minus 1 of y, minus phi n minus 1 of x, phi n of y. Where Bn is the following. So it's, again, the following fact holds for any system of orthogonal polynomials, not necessarily for this class of weights. But if you think, then another natural thing to do would be to study the operator of multiplication by the independent variable. And if you study such an operator in that basis, it turns out that it is represented by a tridiagonal matrix. So namely, there will be numbers bj and aj so that the following holds, j plus 1 plus bj minus 1 phi j minus 1. And this is called the three-term recurrence relation. And the coefficient here is the nth coefficient from this three-term recurrence relation. So now you see that really, as n tends to infinity, you just have to study the coefficient bn, and then these two orthogonal functions, the nth and the n plus minus first. So that's really the only thing you have to study. And so But again, it's not clear how you can study a general system of orthogonal polynomials. So for Hermite polynomials, there are kind of classical explicit formulae and things like that. But if you even have a weight e to the minus x to the fourth, there are no general formulae, and you don't really know what those polynomials are. However, there is a way to analyze orthogonal polynomials and recurrence coefficients asymptotically as n tends to infinity due to the following fact, and I'm not going to go into details here, but that's really so that's really why these problems were finally analyzed in the late 90s. So it turns out that orthogonal polynomials solve a certain Riemann-Hilbert problem. So the Riemann-Hilbert problem is a problem. So Riemann-Hilbert problem for people in say algebraic geometry, and it is something not quite what we think here. So for us, a Riemann-Hilbert problem is something like that. So we have a contour in the plane, for example, the real line, and then we want to find a solution to which is a matrix function, say a 2x2 matrix, y of z, which is holomorphic on C take away this contour. So there is directions are, we have directions on the contour. And also Y has a prescribed jump on the contour times some jump, some matrix, say some matrix. Well, actually, maybe I even will write it for our situation for the orthogonal polynomials. So here it will be just V. The weight will be here. So this is for Z on the contour. And finally, Y has a prescribed behavior at infinity. So it is equal to Zn, Z, say Zn, Z minus n. 0, 0, identity plus 1 over z, as z tends to infinity. So we're looking for a solution to such a problem, and this is what the Riemann problem is for us here. And it turns out that if we solve, it turns out that the solution will exist, and it turns out that this solution can be analyzed as n tends to infinity. And the why we're interested, why do we have that problem? Because it turns out that if you write down the solution, then its 1-1 entry will be exactly the nth monic orthogonal polynomial corresponding to that weight. And then there will be also, so the quantities here, they also have a meaning, but it's not important for us now. And also, this three-term recurrence coefficient also will enter this element here, actually. But I don't want to write it down now. So this Riemann-Hilbert, the observation that orthogonal polynomials arise can be represented as a solution to the Riemann-Hilbert problem is due to Farkas and Kitaev. And that's around 91. And the way to study an asymptotic analysis of that solution was carried out by Dave and Vinakidis and Zhu. And so I would like now to just state the theorem, which is due to Dave Krieger-Bauer, McLaughlin, okay, Vinakidis and Zhu, that's around 98, 99. So this theorem is this. For any V, which is of the form as I described earlier, so for any polynomial V, the following holds as n tends to infinity. That we compute the function kn. So now we see that in order to study correlation functions, we just have to study the kn. So let's just study the kn at two points. And so I'm stating now the simplest version of the theorem. So the simplest version is like this. So you fix two points, c and eta. And actually, you also fix a point zero here, and you're adding these things to a zero, in fact. But I just want to write down the simplest version like this, and you divide by that. And then, as n tends to infinity, this will be converging to the function sine pi of c minus eta divided by pi c minus eta. And you see that this final answer doesn't depend upon v. So for any v, if you look at such a, it's called a scaling limit. So scaling is because you're kind of taking a not just that you're dividing by something, but you're also changing the variable. That's why I use the word scaling. So, and the limiting kernel, the so-called sine kernel, is independent of the choice of v. And in fact, it has a universal form like that. Now, why do we divide by this? I have like maybe 3 more minutes or something like that. Is it? Yeah. So the thing is that if you compute the expected number of eigenvalues in, say, an interval from minus epsilon to epsilon, it will be equal to the integral from minus epsilon to epsilon of kn t dt times 1 plus little o of 1 as n tends to infinity. So, this is because the first correlation function, it just has a minimum. And the first correlation function is the same as kn by the theorem. And the first correlation function, it has that meaning that the number, expected number of eigenvalues in some interval b is equal to the first correlation function, just integrated over the interval. Okay, R. So that's why we're scaling like that, but that's kind of technical. And you see also that if you look at the second correlation function, limiting correlation function, let me write xi and eta, will be the determinant 1, and then the sine pi of the difference divided by pi of the difference sine and the 1. And then you see that this will be exactly 1 minus the sine divided by the difference squared. And that's the thing that we saw in the zeta functions. There's really a two-point function for the unit ensembles. That describes the behavior of the eigenvalues in the bulk. And this is a universality statement for invariant unitary ensembles, for such a class of ensembles. And I just want to say that together with Dave, we proved the last year and actually, we have two texts about this. So we proved universality also for the same class of weights. Well, actually, they have the five authors up there, they have also a result for more general classes of weights. But we have for that class of weights also universality for the orthogonal and symplectic ensembles. And these are more difficult, mainly due to the fact that not until a paper by Harold Widom, 1998 paper, it wasn't clear how to analyze the correlation functions for those cases. But what Harold Widom did, he managed to write down correlation functions for beta 1 and 4 in terms of orthogonal polynomials. That was a remarkable paper, and physicists immediately said, well, then the universality is clear. But in fact, our first paper is about 90 pages long, so it's not so clear, but fortunately, it can be done, and the main tool there is, again, analysis of orthogonal polynomials. Because before, people thought that a thing to study was so-called skew orthogonal polynomials, but for the skew orthogonal polynomial, it's not so clear if there is a Riemann-Hilbert problem, so it's not so clear how to kind of analyze their behavior asymptotically. But using this Widom's formula, we were able to do that. Okay, thank you very much. Yes?
Are corrections known for this leading asymptotics? We would see more of the potential?
Oh, if the corrections would depend on the potential?
No. I mean, this is the leading asymptotics.
Yeah. So the order will be if X, C, and eta are in say compact set, then it will be 1/n. The error will have order 1/n uniformly for X, C,
and
eta.
Do you have explicit expressions for
it? Well, there are explicit expressions. It's just that they get very different, very big.
But they should depend on V.
That's a good question.
Is that also universal?
No. They will. I think depend on it, but nobody really kind of studies because you just want to obtain this kind of limiting result. So, but in fact, not even if there is a natural an easy thing which depends on V. So the corrections are kind of that's a difficult thing. But if you think about the following, so. What happens with these problems is that the eigenvalues, they will lie on the random matrix. They will, if you divide them by something like the size, so if you divide the eigenvalues by the size of the matrix to the power 1/2m, where 2m is this degree of V, then these things will be, and maybe with some coefficient, and this thing will now converge to some limiting function, which is supported here, and it will be the square root of 1 minus x squared times some polynomial of x of degree 2m minus 2. So you see. So this is the limiting density of the eigenvalues. And this polynomial, for the case of Gaussian ensemble, this polynomial is just a constant. So you get what is known as Riemann semicircle, say a semicircle. However, this polynomial, it depends on V. So already this natural thing depends upon V. This is why we're scaling there. So in fact, what we do, we take a point here, and then we appoint x, and then this thing is, we go C of x. And we kind of divide by the density of the eigenvalues. That's what happens. So it's like you consider the point x, and then you consider something like that. So what you want the expected density, the expected number of scaled eigenvalues in a unit interval to be equal to 1. This is what you want to do. So you see, the scaling here, it depends upon the potential. And when you do that, then the limiting answer will not. But even this natural thing will depend upon it. So, yes?
How does the data function know to obey the unitary ensemble, not the orthogonal or the symplectic
How it's known?
How does the zeta function decide which ensemble to obey?
Well, this is proven, and in fact, there are other kind of number theory functions that have been studied now. But
some of them obey other ensembles?
There are, yes, I'm not an expert in that field, but I think that there are more, even not just three classes of ensembles, there are even more ensembles there. And then something like seven classes of ensembles. And then different classes of L functions are proven to obey some different statistics, but I'm not really an expert in that field. So, and then maybe I just, if there are no more questions, I just fit, yes.
This paper you cited by Focus, it's in Kitayev.
Yes.
Is that the same Kitayev that's now at Caltech? Or
No, it's a different Kitayev. Yeah. So the one in quantum optics, quantum computing, is a different one. Yeah. So, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, I think, I'm almost sure. Okay. So, because I know the one at Caltech, and I'm pretty sure that he's not the one from the field. Anyway, so I just want to tell the following. It's something to think about, is that there is this interesting, duality, if you want, that on the one hand, you have integrable systems like this hydrogen atom without the magnetic field. And then you can compute things. And then it turns out that in this simple case, when you can compute things, then the eigenvalues don't know about each other, the distance of Poisson distributed. On the other hand, when you have this chaotic system, say if magnetic field is very high, you can't compute anything except for numerical things, but the eigenvalues, they know very well about each other, and they repel. So that's one of those facts that one could lose their mind if you think too much about them. But
I've known for a very long time that the electrons are smarter than I am.
Right. Okay.
It's one of our wonderful correlations.
Yes.
If I had just walked in the room and looked at your blackboard, I'd look down there and I'd say, "Oh, Laughlin wave functions."
What did you say?
They remind me of Laughlin wave functions for the quantum Hall effect.
This is real. This is not real. Complex.
Right. Yeah.
But the analogy has been used.
Okay. Thanks. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.